Thank you. Morrison, Sherlock Monk, Atlas Shrugged, was now the second most influential book in the country. The first was the Bible. And the group most inspired by were the new entrepreneurs of Silicon Valley, including some of the most powerful, like Larry Ellison or Oracle. Many of them named their companies and even their children after Rand and her mother. They set up reading rooms to spread their ideas. But above all, they saw themselves as Randian heroes.
I really felt like an Iron Man hero. I really did feel like an Iron Man hero. I was one. I didn't just feel like one. I was one. I was building a box. I was thinking independently. I was being rational. I was taking pride in what I did. Those are Iron Man heroes' characteristics. I was an Iron Man hero. I wasn't in the book, but I was an Iron Man hero.
Just give you an example, my 6-year-old boy, his middle name is Rand. And I was talking to someone, a classmate's dad, and I was just saying, you know, we're talking about Rand in this interview, and he said, I'm a huge Rand fan. In fact, my girl's middle name is Aya. And it's funny when you see people, you see companies all the time, you know, called Fountainhead or the Golf Group, and you see little evidence that Rand has heavily influenced people.
Many of the people here in Silicon Valley were really inspired by Ayn Rand. Entrepreneurs who were building computers, entrepreneurs in biotech, entrepreneurs in software, and internet networking, many here were inspired by Ayn Rand. It presented a vision. It presented a vision of a morally exciting enterprise, a morally glorious project.
But the project was about more than just the entrepreneurs being Randian heroes. Because an idea was emerging in California that said that the new computer technologies could turn everyone into heroic individuals. It was a vision of a society where the old forms of political control would be unnecessary, because computer networks could create order in society without central control. This had never happened before, because at the heart of Western political thought had always been a fear that if you allow individuals too much freedom, you would get angry. But ever since the 1970s, computer utopians in California believed that if human beings were linked by webs of computers, then together they could create their own kind of order. It was a cybernetic dream which said that the feedback of information between all the individuals connected as nodes in the network would work to create a self-stabilizing system. The world would be stable, yet everyone would be heroic Randian beings, completely free to follow their desires. Now, in the 1990s, technologies had been built. But in 1991, a leading computer engineer from California gave a dramatic demonstration. He was called Lauren Hart. He invited hundreds of people to a large shed. On each seat was a small panel, and in front of them was a giant screen.
We told them nothing for a while. We just left the things on the seats, and people would pick this up and look at it, things like that. And then somebody noticed that there's a little red and green dot up there on the screen. And this is red and green. So maybe that has something to do with that. Would be that. Okay, there I am. And when that happened, the room erupted. Just focus on this. We will say
that. Hart then began an experiment. He projected the early computer game, Pong. Each half of the audience joined the control of the bat on their side of the screen. If an individual held up red on their panel, a computer sensor picked it up, and the bat on the screen went down. If they held up green, it went up. But they had to operate it together.
When the game is being played, the ball is going back and forth. If it's down here, and it's headed that way, some people are going to have to show red to keep it from going all the way to the top. If everybody can show green, it would fly off the top and go with this. So something happened in that group of people where some decided to show green and some decided to show red to cause it to stop in the right place. And we have no idea what did that.
believe what he had created was a mock of a society where there was no hierarchy, where everyone made their own decisions without guidance. Yet because they were linked by the machines, out of it came stability and an order.
So they're all acting as individuals because each one of them can decide what they're going to do. They have total freedom of what they decide to do. But there's an order. There's an order that emerges that gives them a kind of an amoeba-like effect where they surge and then they play. It was kind of the nature of an experiment. I wanted to see if no hierarchy existed at all, what would happen?
And what did happen?
They formed a subconscious consensus.
Out of these kinds of ideas came what was called the Californian ideology. It was an odd fusion of radical individualism and utopian theories about computer systems. And an international priesthood rose up to promote it. What united them was a vision that the world was now one interconnected system. The nation states were irrelevant, and politicians should not try and control the system. They should let it free to create a new kind of democracy.
All the mechanisms that we are creating with are connecting everything to everything else. They let the individual do their thing.
The internet, as it spreads, is going to radically accelerate that process of network formation. A different kind of global governance.
We need a fundamental evolution of the global system in the post Cold War era.
And people, us consumers, have moved into the 21st century. New citizens, networkers, who will reshape the world.
You have citizens forming networks, local, global society, planetary consciousness,
where they are absolutely liberating the individual.
Well, the power has shifted to the citizens, and the government must be a facilitator. They should not, in the traditional sense, control and regulate.
But at this very moment, the new president of the United States was elected, who believed the opposite. He was convinced that he could use political power in its traditional way to transform the world for the better.
You have to realize that Alan Greenspan was and is a brilliant mind, doing brilliant things in the real world, but in his 20s, he's sitting with me in New York in our apartment, my apartment, and telling me that he cannot say for a certainty that he exists, and he cannot say for a certainty that I, Nathaniel, exist, and he cannot say for a certainty that this conversation exists. That aside, he's got lots of opinions about everything, how the economy works, how the world works, but he denies the possibility of being certain about anything, even, and this of course is reductive and absurd, even he cannot be certain that he exists. So my challenge became to persuade him that he can be certain that he exists.
Alan Greenspan believed in a philosophy called logical positivism. It was an extreme form of rationality that questioned everything and used logic to reach absurd conclusions. To try and save him from this, Nathaniel Brandon introduced Greenspan to Ayn Rand. Brandon and his wife Barbara were the leaders of the small group that had formed around Ayn Rand. They jokingly called themselves the Collective. And they met in Rand's apartment every Saturday night to read the latest section of the novel that she was writing, called Atlas Shrugged.
Nathaniel liked him. I did not like him at all. Nathaniel did, and began discussing ideas with him. And every Saturday night, the collective gathered to read what I had written, to read in manuscript what I had written about the strike that week. And finally, Nathaniel persuaded I to include Alan in that. And he loved the book, and he became a loyal member of the collective.
Atlas Shrugged is set in a science fiction world. and one which is very similar to 1950s America. In it, Ayn Rand attacks head-on the idea of altruism, the care of others, as an organizing principle for society. In the story, the government and the state control everything. But one by one, the creative individuals in America, the industrialists, the inventors, and the artists, are all mysteriously disappearing. They have gone on strike, and they hide out in a remote mountain valley as America falls apart. At the end of the book, they reappear and set out to build Rand's vision of the world to come. A world in which politics has disappeared and is based instead on what she called the virtues of selfishness. The critics hate it.
And let me start by quoting from a review of this novel at the Shrug that appeared in Newsweek. It said that you are out to destroy almost every edifice in the contemporary American way of life, our Judeo-Christian religion, our modified government-regulated capitalism, our rule by the majority will. Are these accurate criticisms?
Yes. I'm challenging the moral code of altruism, the precept that man's moral duty is to live for others, that man must sacrifice himself to others. I say that man is entitled to his own happiness, and that he must achieve it himself, and nor should he wish to sacrifice himself for the happiness of others. I hold that men should have self-esteem.
Athens Shrugged was the great disappointment of her life. What hurt her terribly was that when it came out, not a single person whom she considered a peer stood up publicly to say what an achievement that book was. Not one. Nobody. Vicious, horrible criticisms. She felt very alienated. And this small group around her, the collective, were the only people she had admitted to, in effect, her private world. The world where that she wasn't alienated from.
Alan Greenspan remained fiercely loyal to Ayn Rand. He married another member of the collective, a painter called Joan Mitchell. Together, they and the other members of the group saw themselves as models for a new kind of world that they were convinced was coming.
Oh, we thought of ourselves as being instigators of a revolution that was coming. We were so enthusiastic about the difference it was going to make to the world. We were there, and we were in on it, and we hoped we were contributing even to it.
And what would that revolution lead to?
A totally free society.
At the end of 1992, Alan Greenspan went to see President Clinton. It was a few days after Clinton had been elected. And what Greenspan said in that conversation was the beginning of a revolution. By now, Greenspan was the head of the US Federal Reserve. And what he told Clinton was that his election promises of social reform were impossible. The government deficit was so large, Greenspan said, that if he borrowed any more to pay for his political program, then interest rates would go up and damage growth. But, Greenspan said, there was a radical alternative. Clinton should do the very opposite. Cut government spending. Then interest rates would go down and the markets would boom. Greenspan's idea was simple. Clinton should let the markets transform America, not politics. He said later that he was surprised that Clinton agreed with him.
I had hoped to invest in your future without asking more of you. And I work harder than I've ever worked in my life to meet that goal. But I can't. Because the deficit has increased so much.
There will be many more budget cuts.
This is the beginning, not the end. The House has already done it. It's the only one.
If our national debt were stacked in $1,000 bills, the stack would reach 267 miles into space.
Thank you. predicted, a boom began. And as share prices rose higher and higher, a belief started to grow that this time the boom would be different. It wouldn't run out of control. And the reason was the computers. The computers allowed the banks to create complex mathematical models that could predict the risk of making any loan or investment. This had enormous implications, because if a risk could be predicted, then it could be balanced by hedging against it. For the banks and the hedge funds, this was like a new world. For in the chaos and the volatility of the markets, the computers had, for the first time ever, created stability. It allowed banks to lend money to millions of people they would never have touched in the past. At the same time, the internet and other computer networks allowed businesses to respond to each other's needs instantaneously, and to the consumer's desires. It was the cybernetic feedback predicted by the Californian ideologists. And the belief arose that America had now entered into a new age of stability, which was called the new economy.
Whether they came from Silicon Valley, or from Washington, from academia, or from Wall Street, there were a number of leading individuals who basically articulated a body of thought now known fondly as the new economy. That it was based on the premise of a dramatic and permanent increase in the rate of productivity growth sparked by new information technologies that would let this thing go on forever. This is sort of manna from heaven. This is the candy that politicians only dream of. I mean, you don't have to do anything. You just push a button. And presto, you've got a brand new economy that creates jobs and prosperity. It's the rising tide that will stay in all boats because there's no water in the ocean.
But Al Greenspan was worried. Every morning in his bath, he read page after page of data about what was really happening in the factories and businesses in America. And what puzzled him was that the figures showed that actually there was hardly any increase in productivity. Yet reported profits kept on going up. There was something wrong. And in 1996, Greenspan made a speech that warned that the market might be overvalued, that a dangerous speculative bubble was being created.
Early December of 1996, Alan Greenspan warned that the U.S. stock market may be in a period of irrational exuberance. And you would have thought the world would come to an end. The politicians attacked him from the left, from the right. Main Street was upset with him. Wall Street was upset with him. And at that point, there was a very unfortunate turn of events because he knuckled under to political pressure. He changed his mind.
Greenspan decided he was wrong. The computers were increasing productivity in ways that were so new, his data couldn't see it. And he went to see President Clinton to tell him the good news. It really was a new economy. Greenspan described it, of course, as like discovering a new planet.
This was a woman who was very powerful in a great many ways, who was mentally more powerful than anyone she met, who was more determined, who was more hardworking than anyone she met, what she would have loved would be to find a man who was stronger than she. She would have loved to meet someone who was smarter than she, braver than she, greater genius. She never met him, but she longed for him on earth. And I think this accounts for her sexual psychology.
In the 1940s, Ayn Rand had married an actor called Frank O'Connor. But now, faced with the hostility of her ideas, Rand turned to the leading member of the collective, Nathaniel Brandon. She told him that she had fallen in love with him. And despite the fact that he was married to Barbara, another member of the collective, Rand told him that the only rational course was for Nathaniel to have an affair with her.
I don't think I must be feeling you making a certain point clear to you, sir. Ayn Rand thought that she was being rational about anything or everything that she did. So it would never occur to me to ask if Ayn Rand thinks she was being rational about that. She would say, if she were here, I could feel her. She would say, "Why, yes, do you think I would do something if I didn't think it was rational?"